Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
A chance encounter, a collision of worlds, and a night they will never forget. I'm Kevin Strasser, and I'd like you to meet Jem, Ari, and Lyra, the stars of my latest single, The Runaways, available now on Spotify.
Since 1983, Eddie Trunk has been the voice for fans of rock, hard rock, and heavy metal. A best-selling author, host of TV's That Metal Show, and seven national radio shows, including Trunk Nation, daily on Sirius XM.
Interesting.
Eddie offers the world his news-making interviews, passionate analysis, honest commentary, and who knows what else. So welcome to the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Welcome, everybody, to another Eddie Trunk podcast. And, of course, the podcast is free and available to you with new episodes going up every Thursday. PodcastOne.com, Spotify, totally free, no subscription needed. And, of course, Apple Podcasts. And, man, do I have an interview for you this week. This interview is with somebody who is basically, I regard at least, as the founding father of the entire world of heavy rock. He is the architect. He is the creator. Now, a few days ago, sadly, we lost one of the architects of rock and roll in Little Richard. This guy would absolutely qualify as being called the architect of heavy metal, and very few, if any, would argue with that statement. Because this week on my podcast, I will bring you about 70 uninterrupted minutes with Tony Iommi. And, you know, what can you say when you get the opportunity to spend that much time and visit with a legend and icon like Tony? It is always a big, big thrill. And I, you know, as life goes on and we all get older, you savor those moments even more. So as I tell you every week, the interview you're about to hear originated and first aired on my daily radio show, Trunk Nation, which is Monday through Friday, 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on Volume, which is channel 106 on Sirius XM. If you're in the U.S. or Canada, be sure to listen every day live, 2 to 4 Eastern, and the replay is every night, 10 to midnight Eastern. And then, of course, the shows go on demand on the app, the interviews, and all that. So I, you know, in the last, I just went back to doing live shows, by the way, a couple weeks ago, on the Sirius XM volume show. And previous to that, everything had to be pre-recorded for a couple months due to the pandemic. So I was going through and randomly taking some shots at having some guests and some people on to keep that show interesting while it was in pre-recorded mode as best I could, and reach out to people that I wanted to talk to who hadn't been on the show in a long time, and who I hadn't interviewed in a long time. Tony Iommi and the Sabbath guys outside of Ozzy, who I really do not know. I only interviewed Ozzy once in my life, and it was a long time ago on the phone, and there's weirdness there. We'll leave it at that. I'm not going to get into all of it now. It's just silly, and it doesn't have anything to do with him, but you can figure it out probably who it has something to do with. But anyway, point being, I've done very little, if ever, anything with Ozzy. And unfortunately, because of Ozzy's representation and whatever they're feeding him, or whatever they believe, when Ozzy is in Sabbath and doing Sabbath, I've done very little with the Sabbath camp. But when Sabbath is dormant, or when they had Dio in the band, I did a ton with that lineup and those guys in Sabbath. So I've established a long time ago connections and friendships and relationships with Tony and Geezer, and of course Ronnie, who's no longer with us. I've seen Geezer quite a bit. I've had Geezer on my shows not too long ago. Geezer bowled with me 2 years in a row now on the Dio Cancer Fund event in L.A. Geezer predominantly lives in Los Angeles. Tony still is based in England. So anyway, I took a swing with Tony because it had been years since I talked to him. And I always loved the guy, and we have a great relationship. There's no issue whatsoever. It's just politics get into the picture sometimes. All this to say, heard back from his manager and said, yeah, Tone would love to catch up with you. And I've said this so many times, the best interviews to me are the ones that aren't about promoting or selling a specific product. It always made me crazy when so many artists will say, well, I'm not doing press right now. I got nothing to promote. If you got a 20, 30, 40, 50-year-old history, I get that most people want to only do interviews when they're trying to sell something, which is most of them. But sometimes, you know, just keeping your story out there and connecting with people and connecting with new fans, or maybe making new fans, is really good to do. And those interviews to me tend to be the best, because it's not, there's not a publicist in your ear or a handler, an agent or a manager pumping you to talk about this, stay on this, keep pumping the record. It's just shooting the shit. And I had a chance to do that with Tony. We talked for 70 minutes, and you're going to hear every minute of it in minutes right here on this week's podcast. And I talked to Tony about all eras of Sabbath. One of the things you will get with the interviews that I do with Tony and Geezer, way more so than probably any other interviews they do, is a focus on the other eras of the band, because those eras are really important to me and a lot of other people. Because for me, it's when I discovered Sabbath. My first Sabbath record was Heaven and Hell. So I, you know, with my age and what have you, that's where I really slot in with Sabbath. And I don't hear a lot talked about some of those other eras, or a lot from other people talking about that. So, and as you're about to hear, Tony really loves to talk about the other eras of Sabbath. I think a lot of other people, to some degree, write that off. So we touch on Tony Martin. We touch on, of course, some Ozzy stuff. We touch, of course, on Dio. We touch on Ian Gillan with some great stories about Born Again. Talk about what Tony's doing now. Talk about the end of Sabbath and how it ended. Just great, great stuff. And, of course, how Tony is doing health-wise. Remember, this is a guy that's been battling cancer. And, you know, what his plans are for the future, and if he has any, now that Sabbath has called it a day. So, to me, in my view, this is, you know, this is as big as it gets in terms of an interview if you're a hard rock or a heavy rock fan. You know, spending over an hour with Iommi, you kidding me? Even though I've interviewed him countless times and known him for a long time, it's still a huge thrill. You will hear it in its entirety in a matter of minutes on this week's Eddie Trunk podcast. I cannot wait for you to check it out. Remember, again, all of the interviews you do here all originate on my SiriusXM radio show, which if you're in the U.S. or Canada, you can hear for free over the app. Be sure to sign up for the free streaming. It goes until the end of May, and you can sign up at SiriusXM.us SiriusXM.com/EddieTrunkSXM. Remember that URL. It'll take you right to my show. SiriusXM.us/EddieTrunkSXM. If you haven't been doing it already and you're not already a subscriber and you're in the U.S. or Canada, sign up for your free listening via the app. And you can hear stuff on demand, hear my show stream live, hear the replay, whatever the case may be. Trunk Nation is on now. Once again, live shows every day, 2 to 4 Eastern on 106. Also want to thank my friends at Goodies. And at Goodies Powder, Goodies makes tremendous products. And their latest is a hangover remedy, which I'm sure many can use. Goodies also was cool enough to make these really cool Trunk Nation bumper stickers for me. If you'd like to get one, I'll send you a couple totally free in the mail. Send me a self-addressed stamp envelope to P.O. Box 41, Cedar Knolls, New Jersey, 07927. Again, that's P.O. Box 41, Cedar Knolls, CedarKnolls, New Jersey, 07927. Just put sticker on the envelope. You must include a self-addressed stamped envelope, and I will send you out a couple stickers. And only addresses in the U.S., please. I just can't get into doing international mailing on stickers. It's just too involved, especially now with the pandemic and customs forms. Can't do it. Don't have the time. But self-addressed stamped envelope, I'll do my best to get you out a couple of these very cool stickers. Thanks to our friends at Goodies. Check out their new headache powder. It is awesome. Goodiespowder.com, the website. There is Fast. And now there is, of course, Goodies Fast. Be sure to check out Goodies Hangover at Walmart, Amazon, and other retailers. And get more information at goodiespowder.com. So, Iommi, that's all you need to say on this week's podcast. Be sure to follow me on social media at Eddie Trunk, Twitter, Instagram, fan page on Facebook. EddieTrunk.com is the official online home. Coming back, we will talk for over an hour all things Sabbath with Tony Iommi on this week's Eddie Trunk podcast.
Podcast One presents. This is a collect call from Sing Sing.
My name is John J. Lennon. I'm locked up for selling drugs and committing murder. I'm also a contributor for Esquire magazine and the Marshall Project. So I'm a writer and I'm a prisoner. Imagine trying to stay focused and talk about issues of substance with gates slamming, prisoners screaming, and PAs blaring in the background.
Get new episodes every Wednesday on Spotify, Podcast One, and Apple Podcasts.
Hey, it's Eddie Trunk. Let's get into it right now. For over an hour, a conversation with the icon, brand new interview, Tony Iommi, on this week's Eddie Trunk podcast. Tony, thank you so much for the time. How are you today?
Very well, thank you, Eddie. Yeah, it's lovely to talk to you as well. It has been such a long time.
It has too been. Before we get into some stuff that I wanted to ask you about, how are you doing? You're in England, I assume, right?
Yes, I'm in England, yeah.
And how are things there? You know, obviously the world we're in, it's pretty just insane with this virus and how it's impacting so many. How are things there where you are? Are you in Birmingham?
No, I'm out of Birmingham. I'm in the place called the Cotswolds, which is way out of Birmingham, an hour and a half, 2 hours out of Birmingham. So it's great. It's a nice village. It's extremely quiet at the moment because normally it's a tourist village, but very quiet. Obviously, with everybody being locked in, you know, it's that's the way it is at the moment. It's very strange.
Yeah, how are you handling it? Are you somebody that normally does go out a lot, or is, you know, I've talked to some people and they're like, well, I kind of quarantine all the time anyway and stay in quite a bit anyway. Is this the norm for you, or is it kind of having an effect on you?
Well, it's knowing that you can't go out. That's what does it with me. I mean, if I don't mind staying in, there's plenty of stuff to do around the house and we can go in the garden if it's nice weather and stuff. So that's good. But I'm so used to being able to pop out when I want to go out. And of course, here, you're only allowed to go out for a quick walk, you know, half an hour or so. And then you're back in the house, unless you have to go shopping for anything. And then, you have to go out as least as you can, really, once a week or what, you know. So it is strange. But again, it's a bit like being on tour, you know. When you're on tour, you're in a hotel room all the time. And you get ready and go and do the show, and then you come back and go to the hotel. So it's a bit the same sort of thing.
Yeah, that's a good point. I never thought of it quite like that, but that's true, actually. And Tony, how is your health? I mean, obviously everybody knows you've battled cancer, and especially with this virus going around, it's incredibly dangerous for people who also have underlying conditions. How have you been health-wise?
I've been fine, dare I say it, Eddie. I feel good, and funny enough, I've just had my specialist phone me up 10 minutes ago to see how I was, because obviously you can't go in. He doesn't want me to come into the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
I supposed to have been in today, but he said, oh, I'm glad you didn't come in, because, you know, it's safer to be at home. But no, I've been feeling good. I feel fine, and just itching to get moving again, you know.
Is this the type of thing, Tony, that you just have to pretty much manage the rest of your life? Do you have to get ongoing treatments and just keep an eye on it? Is it that sort of thing?
More or less. I usually go in every 6 weeks and have blood tests and all the rest of the stuff. So they try and keep on top of it as much as they can to see if there's any change, you know. Of course, anytime I get a pain here or there, oh my God, you start worrying. You know, it's one of those things you live with really now. But I feel fine at the moment.
Yeah, and have you had the opportunity? Have you talked to other musicians who are dealing with things like this? I mean, I think of a guy like, I don't know if you know him or not, Vivian Campbell, who's in Def Leppard.
Yeah.
I talk to Viv all the time and just check in on him. And, you know, same thing. He sort of has to go in and out and get ongoing treatments, and he just knows it's something that's manageable and he has to keep up with. Is it a similar sort of thing? And do you have others in the music community that you've spoken to about it?
I don't really. I do do a lot for the cancer hospital. In fact, I'm a patron of the hospital in Birmingham, a huge hospital here on the cancer ward. And I talk to patients there, but I haven't actually spoke to many musicians. I mean, I know Viv had the same problem. He has to go and get checked and everything. But I've never really spoken to him about it. I don't have an opportunity to see people these days.
Yeah, yeah. You did something charitable for that hospital there in England, did you not? Did I see that there was an event or an auction or something that you did recently?
Yeah, well, recently, you see, I was going to do, I've been doing these evening with Tony Iommi and being interviewed and doing, raising money like that, really. But, of course, the one I was supposed to do got cancelled because of the virus. So I wanted to do something quick. So what I thought, well, I can auction some items. And that's really what we did to try and raise money quick for the hospital here.
Well, that's fantastic. So, you know, of course, we're talking about, health battles and things like that. And it's hard to believe, but we're at the point where it's been 10 years since we lost Ronnie. And it's you know, I do a lot with the cancer fund that Wendy set up. I host the events. I see Geezer all the time. I see Geezer all the time.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you know this, Tony, but I've turned Geezer into a bowler. I don't know if he told you that or not.
No, he hasn't.
So he came and bowled twice now, 2 years in a row on my team for the Dio Cancer Fund. And the first year he did it, he came up to me and he said, I've never bowled in my life. I said, how is that possible? And he came with his own shoes. And the first time he bowled quite well. And then the second time, which was not too long ago, he didn't do quite as well. Let's just leave it at that. He's really into it now. He bowls once a year with me, and there's footage and photos of me, who I am not a good bowler, instructing him how to bowl. I said, if anyone would have ever told me in my childhood that I'd be showing Geezer Butler how to bowl, it's just, but he's very into it. I don't know if you've spoken to him about it.
No, it's funny because bowling is one thing we never did. I mean, we used to do a lot of things together with the band, but we never ever done that. It's funny. No, I do stay in touch with Geese, as I do with the others, but no, he's never mentioned that.
Yeah, well, you know, ask him next time you speak to him. Say, hey, Eddie Trunk tells me you're quite the bowler these days. You know, he had his own shoes and his ball. He was all into it. So we're gonna have to get him some lessons though, because he struggled last time. First time he bowled with me, we won the championship of the tournament. Second time he didn't do so well, but it's all for good fun and it's all for charity, and it's great that he's out there doing some stuff. You know, he's got this band he's working on, as I'm sure you know, Deadland Ritual. Have you gotten the bug at all to play music, Tony? Are you writing? Are you thinking about doing something musically at some point? We know Sabbath is retired for the most part, but have you thought about doing some stuff?
Yeah, I am. I still, every night I play and put something down. But funny enough, Eddie, I was due to be working now with my engineer. But of course, you can't have anybody in your house. So because of the lockdown, which is Mike Exeter, who I've used for years, you know,
right?
And he'd done the Sabbath stuff with us and whatever. And we got it in the book to come over and start putting some of the things I've got here down, because I've got so much stuff. I just want to get the things down now. So that was the original plan. And of course it went pear-shaped, and I spoke to him today, funny enough, on this, and we're talking maybe we might try this where you can do it with the Zoom over the internet and swap, you know, he can record me somehow. But hopefully when it all clears up, then yes, we'll definitely be starting. Yeah, I do have the bug to do something. I mean, it's certainly not world touring and stuff like that, but I do enjoy playing.
What do you envision when you say get it down? You mean you want to get your parts down? What do you envision doing with it, or what would you like to do with it? Would it be in the form of a solo record, are you thinking, or maybe work with some of the other folks from the Sabbath years that are? I mean, you know, you've done stuff with Glenn Hughes, of course, Tony Martin. I mean, where would you think direction wise it would go?
Well, there's just nothing actually set in stone, Eddie. I've got a few ideas and a couple of big things that could happen. But what my plan is at the moment is just to, when I say put it down, see, a lot of my stuff, I actually do record on a phone, and I put the ideas down just on an acoustic or a electric guitar, just quickly. I put the ideas down, and I have them copied onto a, CD. I'm still into CDs. I don't go
Me
into
too.
All these. I'm not too technical.
Yeah, no, I love CDs.
And, yeah, and then I, what the plan is, when I say put them down, I want to then get Mike over, and then we'll start putting some drums and bass in, and then do a guitar, so we can make it sort of like a proper band, really, proper sound. And then decide who I'm going to work with on it. I just want to have something to present to whoever I'm going to be working with, or if not, at least have something there, you know, that sounds reasonably good.
I mean, I've talked to you about this years ago, but everybody rightfully thinks of you as one of the all-time great, the greatest riff master, and overall great guitar player as well. And you have, are you the kind of guy, though, Tony, that you have a bank of riffs? Like, are you constantly, even now, things coming into your head that you're reaching for the phone, or do you also have a huge backlog of them, of things that haven't been used that you repurpose? Is it both scenarios, or do you only write for the moment?
Well, both, actually. I've got so many things down on CD that I've done in the past. Like when we were doing the 13 album, I I wrote most of those ideas before we ever started doing the... I mean, when I presented them to the rest of the guys, I had three or four CDs full of just riffs, and I played them to the other guys, and then we picked out which ones that they liked. And I'd do some with them. We'd sort of work on the format of them. But most of the stuff I've done like that, and I've got so many more that I'd like to use. But I tend to sort of don't go back on them all the time. I'll do them and then put them away and then do something new, because I keep coming up with new ideas. But I need to now, and I should take the opportunity now while I've got to stay in the house, of looking back over them and seeing what I've got and trying to make a lot of them. But there's so much stuff. I mean, I've got stuff that goes back for years, you know.
The first Sabbath album, as you know, recently turned 50 years old. What are your thoughts about that? And do you have material and outtakes from that early on?
No, I don't have anything from that period. I do have stuff from when we were rehearsing, probably around, I don't know, Masters of Reality, Sabotage, maybe on them. There's bits of stuff. But again, I don't know where half of them are. I've got them, but I've got so much stuff that I probably wouldn't go back that far. I mean, and some of the things I do remember anyway. I remember in my head. For some reason, I'm pretty good at remembering those things. Everything else I can't remember, but I can remember riffs. So I tend to sort of can hold riffs in my head. So there is quite a lot of stuff, and it's just a matter of picking out now. And I've got the opportunity now, where before, when I was touring all the time, you don't have time to sort of, you're more concerned with doing the show and your sound and everything else. But now, and I've not been touring for a while, it's good to be able to reflect and look at this stuff again.
Yeah, organization is the biggest problem that I have. I mean, just when I look at my own radio career, which is almost 40 years now, I have boxes lined up in my basement of in every format, whether it be CDs or DATs or mini discs or whatever, and some of it's labeled, some of it isn't, and it just gets overwhelming, and I just turn my back on it, and I say, oh, the hell with it, I can't worry about it. Another 10 years goes by, and that's the biggest problem. So I can only imagine maybe something similar for you, where it becomes overwhelming at some points.
Well, it has. I mean, I've got stuff that was on, like, the old tape stuff, and had it transferred to cassette. My Guitar Tech transferred a lot of stuff to cassette, and then from cassette to CD. And it's mind-boggling to sit there for hours listening to stuff. You can only do so much. It's great to have it. I mean, I'm not complaining about having it. I'm really pleased. There's so much stuff that I need to sort it out. But I'd sooner be in that position than not having anything.
And you're still creating. The way you come up with stuff, do you sit down and grab a guitar and say, I'm going to work on writing some songs right now? Or is it the type of thing where it just comes to you and then you stop what you're doing and, oh, let me grab it? I mean, I've talked to artists who do it all different ways. They have to dedicate time to sit down and write, and others will wake up in the middle of the night and put something down. How does it work for you? And is it different now than how it used to be?
No, I can tend to go in a room, and start coming up with stuff. What I tend to do now at the moment, I tend to wait till I go to bed for some reason. I don't know why that is, but maybe I'm more tired and I can come up with stuff. I don't know. And I come up with, I might put five or six ideas down within, 10 minutes, and then don't go back to them. I just put them down, and then I'll probably do somewhere else tonight and then somewhere else tomorrow. So they just mount up. But they're only bits, just a riff. But that's when the time will come then, when I'll listen to these and say, oh, I like that riff. And then I'll make something of it, make something with it. So I tend to do them, come up with them on the spot, really.
Are you okay with how Sabbath ended? I mean, it's been a little while now. The final run, the final tour. Are you okay with how it's ended? Was that a good experience for you the last go around?
It was great to be able to go out and do a final two. I mean, to be honest, I felt a bit bad with it because basically it was my choice, my fault, because, you know, touring for me at that extent wasn't a good thing for physically.
You know, for your health.
Of my health. Right. Yeah. I mean, to get in at 4 o'clock in the morning from doing the gig after you've done the gig and fly back to the hotel, you know, it was there was a lot of late nights, and you're living a life of like I used to when I was 20, and it just, I mean, even now we were traveling the best, where we had our own plane, we had fabulous hotels, and we'd base ourselves, say, in New York or Los Angeles for 10 days and somewhere else, and do it like that, go out, do the gig, fly out, do the gig, come back. But by the time you've done that, you got back into the hotel, it's usually, you know, 3 or 4 o'clock by the time you get to bed. And it was just difficult. And my doctor said to me, you know, it's to try and calm me down a bit. And it just seemed like the right thing to do at that time, and it was to finish. I mean, if it had been with me, I mean, especially after the Ronnie thing, I mean, I really loved that period when we had Back to Dio, you know. We were really cracking on with that band, and it was a great band. And then we'd done the Sabbath thing with us, which was great as a finish up, you know. But I should think if Ronnie was alive, I'd probably be doing something with him now, you know.
Yeah, well, so you don't rule out ever playing live again. It doesn't sound like just large scale touring. If the opportunity came up, it sounds like you'd be open to doing a show or two somewhere, but not necessarily the rigors of the road.
Yeah, I think that'd be good if you could do that. I mean, the hard thing is because certainly with Sabbath, it got to such a big thing where you can't just do an occasional show because of the crew. You have to have the amount of crew, you've got to have the whole setup, and it had to be a year or 18 month tour, you know, to be able to go out and do, say, every couple of weeks, do 4 shows or something. That would be fine, but I don't know. I'm not opposed to doing anything. I just would do it in a different way, but I'm more at the moment want to get myself with the music, get together and see what I'm going to do with it, really, and see if I want anybody on it or not.
Yeah,
vocally, that is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, would you consider doing an instrumental record? Is that something that appeals to you?
Well, everything is open at the moment, to be honest.
Yeah.
You know, I've been offered to do some film music and stuff like that. So everything's sort of, I'll leave it all open and whatever comes along. And if it sounds good and I get excited about it, then that's sort of the way I'll go. But and the good thing is you don't have to do it. So it takes a bit of pressure off. You know, if I say I'd like to do it, then it's good because it's my choice. And I say, well, I'll do that. You know, when you're booking tours like we had, when you first go, yeah, it's great, let's go and do it, let's go and do it, and then realize it's 18 months you've got to go on for, you think, oh, you get halfway through and blimey, I'm really tired. but you know, I loved it. There's nothing better than actually being playing on stage. It's such a great excitement. And I do miss that.
You know, and one other project that I wanted to ask you about before I hit you with a few other things is you had said, I had read, I don't know, a year or two ago, I thought something real interesting that you were going to revisit and maybe remix or work on a Sabbath record that a lot of people may not even realize came out because it didn't do well and it was poorly received at the time. But the record you did with Tony Martin called Forbidden, there was reports that you were going to revisit and wanted to redo that record in some way. Is that something you're still considering doing?
It's done. It's all done.
Oh, really?
I went in and done that quite a while back now. But of course it's been held back because we've got the stuff, different stuff coming out, you know, we've had the Aussie stuff and going on, and then we'll have the Dio stuff. So we don't want to bombard everything at once. So it'll come out at the right time when it's ready, really. But it's all as far as the mixing and that. Yeah, it's just, and I mean, I think it sounds better, but it might not. But I was pleased with it.
So you went in and remixed that record. Is that what you did? You remixed it?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. You can't add it. You can't start going and change it, which I like to go in and go, oh, I'll change that bit. I'll change it. But you can't. It has to be like it was because it was out and people know how it goes. So what we've done is trying to thicken the sounds up on the drums and just make it more full.
And why that record, Tony? Is that because of what I said? Because that you felt that record was somewhat overlooked and you wanted to, of all the records in your catalog and all the stuff you did post-original lineup, is it because that record was so sort of, I guess, certainly in America, not well-received, that you wanted to give it another look?
Well, I wanted to, for my own personal thing, really, just to make it sound better.
Right.
And it was one of the records I could get hold of and do it. I'd have liked to have done it, to be honest, with Born Again. But we can't find all the tapes. Some of the tapes have got lost. Mm. And nobody seems to know where they are. But I'd have loved to have done it with Born Again. But I think that could have sounded far better.
Yeah, I would love to hear that remixed as well. Although that's always a really interesting record because that album was also not well received, at least here in America at the time. But in retrospect, there's a lot of people that love that record and actually do love the sound of it. You know, I'd love to hear an alternate mix of it, but that record has really grown in stature with people in recent decades.
It's funny how that happens. It's the same as the Tony Martin stuff, you know, when you do it and then it takes years before people go, oh, yeah, I really like that. Oh, that was good. I've never heard that. And it sort of start catching on to it. Because, I mean, Tony done some great stuff, you know. He done some good work, I think, with Tony.
You know, the Tony Martin stuff, of course. But, you know, I had a chance to tour with Deep Purple and travel with them about a year and a half ago. They toured Mexico, and I spent a lot of time with those guys. And Ian Gillan was nice enough to ask me to dinner one night, and I had like a 4-hour. I know Ian, you and Ian are close, and I had like a 4-hour dinner with Ian, and he was ordering Sambuca and tequila, and, you know.
Yeah, I know.
I'm sure you do. It was wonderful, wonderful desserts, and we just had an amazing night, and we just talked about everything. And he said we were talking about Born Again, and I said, you know, that album has taken on new meaning. People really do love that record now. And he said something to me. He said, yeah, he goes, it was a fun time. And he said, I just remember I got in trouble from my manager. And I said, what happened? He said, well, he said, I got so drunk one night, the guys asked me to join the band. He said, I said, yeah, it hit the press. He said, I got a call from my manager. He said, before you go and join a major band, you might want to consult with me. Do you recall it happening
that way? Oh, exactly. Yeah, we met up in Oxford at a famous pub there called The Bear. And he'd come in from Kuala Lumpur, he'd flown in from. And Giza and myself arranged to meet him in Oxford, which is not far from me here. And we got in this pub. We ended up there at, 11 o'clock in the morning. And we were there all day, all day. They locked us in at the end. And we were so drunk at the end. And of course, he agreed to join, and we agreed to doing something together. And his manager Phil Bamford said, "Ian, if you're going to make any big decisions, can you let me know first?" It was funny, but I must say we had some bloody great fun. And Ian's a really good friend, and I've just not that long ago was together with him again. We went to Armenia. And
because you guys did that charitable recording for the schools,
we did,
right?
Yeah, we did. That was many years ago. And then we, just the two of us, put something together to raise money to build a school there. And we had Nico from Iron Maiden play on it, and and Jason from the bass player from Metallica. And it was great. I mean, we'd done a couple of songs to put on an album, and Ian put some of his stuff, and I put some of our stuff, and whatever, to raise money to build this school, and we managed to do it. So we went over. I'd never seen the school because I was on tour at the time while all that was going on. But this time I had an opportunity to go over, and the president invited us over for dinner, Ian and myself. So off we go to Armenia, and it was fantastic. I mean, we had a great time, and Ian and myself had a really good time and chat and drink and everything else. But no, it was very good.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the time with him, and he and I have stayed in touch, and it's funny when I think about it, because about an hour and a half into the dinner, I'm sure he has a woman that travels with him that looks after his health, because he has some health issues, and he's ordering desserts and tequila, and she's just shaking her head with her hand in her face going, oh boy. And I said, it's your job to look after him. I can't even imagine.
Oh, yeah, she was there when we went to Armenia, because I had my PA and he had his. And both of our PAs are trying to look after us. And, of course, when you sit with Ian, you're sitting with him, and we end up talking about old times. And then we even talk about, let's do something together again. Yeah, that's a good idea. That's a good idea. So it's like, it's never changed. It's great. He's a good mate, and we get on great.
And he's singing really well now. He, last time, and Purple just made a new record, which they've delayed because of the virus, but he's I was speaking to him about it. He said, now that he's well on in years, he had to adjust the way he sings, but he sings really, really well. It's the best I've heard him in a really long time. That Purple stuff, not easy to do, but he's really found a comfort zone with his voice now, I think.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it, with anybody of our age, from our generation. Your voice, you can't do what you did 40 years ago. It's impossible. There's very rarely many people. I mean, Glenn Hughes is one of the ones that's been extremely lucky, and he's been able to, he can go out and he can really cut it. But a lot of them can't, because your voice changes, and you know, and same as playing wise, you're not as fast as you were 40 years ago. You just change and you adapt to that. And so I can see Ian adapting to it, because I mean, he used to sing really high, with Purple, and when he came with us and we'd done Born Again, we'd done a track that he started singing really high on, and I thought, bloody hell, he's never going to be able to do this live, but he would have a go. But yeah, he was great.
Yeah, you talk about Glenn, who I speak to often, and he's I just call him a freak. Glenn is aging in reverse. I mean, he's grown his hair out again, his voice. I mean, I saw him do a Deep Purple show. He's 5 feet away from the microphone, and it's still soaring. Glenn, I told him, I said, you've made some sort of deal with the devil or something, because he's ridiculous. I don't know what's going on with that guy. He's truly amazing.
Phenomenal. You can't believe it, can you? I mean, I know all the stuff he went through in the early days, and he's come out of it, and he sort of wants it more than ever, and he's determined to do it, and he goes out with the right attitude. He loves what he does, and he can sing. He can sing.
Yeah, really can. Hey, so I want to talk to you about another guy that could certainly sing, and that is Dio, who we lost 10 years ago, and Heaven and Hell turned 40 a week or so ago. I want to talk to you about that, but one thing that I want to go back on that you had mentioned. So when I asked you about Forbidden and when that might come out, you said, well, there's the Ozzy stuff and the Dio stuff. Is there stuff coming in the pipeline from those eras of the band? Are there reissues or are there unreleased material? Do you have projects lined up with those eras coming?
Well, I can't talk too much about that because it's all in the pipeline. They're putting a package together, and the Dio stuff will be one of them. Again, we go sorting around to find stuff that's odd bits, that people haven't heard. That's what we sort of done with the Aussie years, and they always seem to put out these box sets, It's not just us. It's the record company that want to do it, and you know. So we go along with it. If it can be a good package, that's great. But Ronnie certainly deserves to get aired more now.
Well, there was what started the whole, because I was there. I interviewed you guys in Birmingham. It was 06, I believe.
I remember, yeah.
Started the whole third and final run with Ronnie was the fact that there was that Dio Years collection that came out with the three new songs on it. And then that led to the whole full-fledged reunion. So is there material you'd like to revisit from that era, or stuff that you want to put out another collection, maybe some unheard things?
Well, as I say, I can't really say too much about it, Ed, because I don't much know what's going to go on it. But we have got bits and dabs that's been about from beforehand. We'll have to see. But it'd be great to have a nice package out of the Ronnie stuff.
Is it, for me, Heaven and Hell, just turning 40, is crazy to me. I've told you guys this many times in the past. For me and many others around my age, Heaven and Hell was my introduction to Black Sabbath. It was my first Sabbath record. And to me, still to this day, it's an amazing record that sounds incredible. Are you amazed at how Heaven and Hell is looked at now? Because I imagine at that time, even though you had an incredible singer with Dio, the prospects of moving forward without Ozzy had to be daunting. Now it's an incredibly celebrated record and period of the band, but at that time, I imagine it was quite difficult.
Well, it was. We took on something because we believed in it, and we just went ahead against all, it's not going to do any good, you're never going to do it, you know. And the idea was we just played it because we enjoyed what we did. And when we did that album, we knew we had a good album. Great album, and it was really exciting again to be able to redo, to do stuff in a different way, you know, to write with a different person. And Ronnie was great to work with, you know, to sit down and write. It was a different way to working with Ozzy, because Ozzy had his way of singing, and we didn't want to bring somebody else in after Ozzy'd gone who sounded like Ozzy, because we had a couple of people who claimed they sounded like Ozzy. I mean, Ozzy's Ozzy, and that's it. There's only one Ozzy. So Abby and Ronnie was such a different vocal way of singing. And also, he was a musician as well, so you could sort of say, well, you're like this, and he'd go, yeah, why don't we change that bit? And it worked, you know. You try. We taught him stuff, and he showed us stuff. It just a nice combination.
Him coming.
I remember when we did.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I remember when we did Die Young. Sabbath was always doing time changes and stuff like that, and suddenly dropped down to a quiet bit. And I remember when we were putting Die Young together, and I dropped down to this quiet bit in the middle where it goes, Die Young, da, da, da. And Ronnie goes, well, you can't do that. I said, well, yeah, you can. I said, we do it many times. This is how we write. We do a quiet bit and a loud bit. And at the end of the day, he said, well, bloody hell, yeah, it's really good. I really like it. And he got into the way we wrote, and we sort of helped each other, if you know what I mean. It sort of worked as a good package.
Did you guys, at that time, Tony, I'm assuming Ronnie first came to your attention from Rainbow. Had you seen Rainbow? Had you toured with Rainbow? Did you go to see Dio playing with Rainbow? Is that where he first got on your radar as a potential new singer for Sabbath?
No. I met Ronnie at a party, and we were talking, and It was a funny time for me because I was getting a bit disgruntled with everything because we were, you know, things weren't sort of happening so well with us, and you know, the band was coming to a funny stage in our lives, and nothing was happening, and I really got a bit sort of, oh God, you know, and I actually thought of sort of doing something myself, and when I talked to Ronnie, the idea was at first maybe we could do something together. And then when it came to that Ozzy went, I called Ronnie and I says, look, you know, we've got Ozzy's no longer with us, he's left, and, you know, would you be interested? So, yeah. So he came over and we sort of did a sort of an audition. He auditioned us, we auditioned him. And we were really happy. We were all happy. It worked really well. And it was exciting again. It was a challenge for us, you know, because we didn't know, you know, the fans have to accept it, of course. But it was something we felt that was right. And I know when we went to Don Arden and said, well, about Ronnie, and Don's comment was, you can't have a midget singing for Black Sabbath. I mean, I said, Don, you've got his voice, it's just that voice, you know. And the way Ronnie sang was, it just added a dimension to it that we hadn't had before. Because with Ozzy, it was great the way Ozzy sang for what we were doing then. But when Ronnie came in, we changed the way of writing. Heaven and Hell was a different way of writing to where it would have been with the other stuff before that. Because where Oz could sing on riffs, Ronnie didn't particularly want to sing on a riff, he'd sing on chords. So it was a different way for us too, so it was a challenge, but it worked.
Were there thoughts at that time, because you're right, obviously the end of Sabbath with Ozzy at that time was a rough time as far as the condition you guys were in, the records, the quality of the shows. Was there a thought in your mind at that point when you started entertaining working with Ronnie that it would be a different project, or was it always going to be continuing with Bill and Geezer and bringing in Ronnie under the Sabbath name? Was it always going to be Sabbath, or was there some thoughts that, well, maybe I'll just grab Ronnie and we'll do something brand new?
No, once he came in, it was with Bill and Geezer. And at the time then, though, Geezer was going through a few problems, so he left. So it was a bit all over the place, to be fair. Because he had some problems of his own going on, which I won't go into, but he did, and he left, and so he went, oh crikey, and that's why I brought Jeff Nichols over, just to stand in a bit, you know, to try and help out, because Ronnie played bass in a sort of a fashion, and we tried various bass players, you know, the guy from Boston, the bass player, and some other guy from Ginger Baker's band. So we tried various ones. It just wasn't right. And in the end of the day, thank goodness, Geezer came back. But he came back at a later period once we'd written a fair bit of Heaven and Hell.
But he came back in time to play bass on the whole record?
Yes, he did. Yeah.
So
yeah.
He got in time for recording.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And do you remember, Ronnie always told me the first song that you and he ever wrote together was Children of the Sea, which is amazing to me because it's such an amazing song for that to be the first thing. That would tell me pretty quickly, yeah, this is going to work. Do you remember that experience? Do you remember that first writing session?
Yeah, I do. Well, I had that riff beforehand because we tried that with Oz. And it was just one of those you play, and that was it. You never sort of done anything with it. And so once Ronnie came in, we developed it into a song. So that was the first one we sort of worked on, really.
That was knocking around for a little bit then, and it finally came to written.
Yeah, I had the riff. I had the beginning part, the choir part, and then the riff, where it goes loud. I had that part, and that's as far as we went. And so as Ronnie came in, then we sort of started working on it.
You know, I just spent a lot of time on my show with Vinny Appice. I had Vinny on a week ago, and Vinny was sharing a lot of great stories about his time, which would come pretty quickly here in the storyline. But we were talking about the live shows at the time with Dio being introduced as the singer in Sabbath. And Vinny had said that even when he got to the band playing live, that although there were a lot of fans that loved Ronnie and the band, it was also pretty rough for him on the road at times because people were upset, where's Ozzy and that sort of thing. What was your view on that? Was that a tough thing? Were you able to encourage Ronnie through it? Did he get very despondent about it at times? How did that go down?
He was pretty resilient, Ronnie. He sort of would battle through it, you know. And he knew it wasn't going to be an easy task to do. And you can't replace Ozzy as such. You can't replace him. Ozzy was Ozzy, and that was it. So to bring Ronnie in, you've got to try and everybody to accept, or as many people as you can to accept Ronnie, and accept the band the way it was then. So it did. It was a bit of nail biting at first, but we just battled through it. And obviously, there was people that wouldn't hear anybody else but Ozzy. They wanted Ozzy, and then there was people that go, "Oh yeah, I like this." So you had to sort of go through that period, and I can understand that because you know, if you've got a band and you're a fan of the band, and anybody that goes, it's like, "Oh well, he's not with them now." And particularly if a singer goes, it's even worse, really. So it was difficult. It was very difficult. But we plodded on. And at the time, we had everybody against us then. I mean, Don Harden, who was at the time sort of managing us, and it was a difficult situation to replace Ozzy at that time. And because we sort of fell out with Don as well. Because we were convinced what we got, and we were happy with what we got, and that was basically Bill and myself then, because Geezer at the time had sort of gone away to sort his problems out, and then when he come back, we got some stuff lined up that he could hear and say, "Oh yeah, I like that," and obviously Geezer put the final touch on it, you know, and brought it back to a Sabbath thing again.
I mean, it's such an interesting period for me because out of that, you're coming off of, with Sabbath at that point, not only introducing to many a new singer, but even if you look back at the last run of touring that you did and the last go round with Ozzy, which I guess would have been 78, 79, I mean, that was equally, for different reasons, a really rough time for you guys, right? I mean, the wheels were sort of coming off on that final Ozzy tour.
Yeah, it was. It was difficult for us. I mean, I think that last tour we took Van Halen out with us, and
that couldn't have made it easy having them open for you as a young band. There's some video footage. There's some, Tony, I don't know if you've seen. There's some video footage from Fresno. I could send you the link. There's a guy in Fresno, California. I don't know how, but back in those days, he set up a camera in the audience somewhere hidden, and really? All the bands that came through that arena, he filmed their performance, and he's just now 43 years later, putting out these clips, and he has footage of you guys playing there, but he also shot Van Halen opening for you. And I was just like, my gosh, can you imagine if you're Sabbath, who are sort of creaking along at that point, and you've got this guy coming out ahead of you, and you know, David Lee Roth spinning around and Eddie Van Halen, the band was on fire. I was like, oh my goodness, maybe that wasn't the smartest opening act booking at the time.
Well, the thing was, you see, we had opening acts. We didn't pick opening acts that we'd say, oh, we're better than them, or we'll do this and we'll do that. We wanted a good show. We wanted to make it a good show. So, and it happened that Van Halen made it a great show. They were really up and light. We were like sort of a bit dinosaur-y by that point, you know, and they were all new on the block and come out and very energetic and offered something different, you know, the way Eddie played. It's a whole new way of playing. And it was great. And we got on really great with them. And I used to have Eddie back in my room quite a lot. We used to be talking about guitars and this and that. We had a great time. And he's still one of my dear friends. So, yeah, I mean, it was they were good. They were bloody good, and they deserved to get. You could tell they were going to get somewhere.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing to see that band that early on. So the stuff with Ronnie, that first tour happens, and now 40 years later, when you look back on Heaven and Hell, what are your thoughts on the record? Do you ever go back and listen to your old records start to finish, or do you just hear things when you have to play them? What are your recollections on Heaven and Hell, and when is the last time you actually listened to it?
I don't think it was too long ago. I really liked Heaven and Hell, and Mob Rules I liked as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I must be honest, I really did. I thought they were great albums. And it's amazing, those albums, like you said, started a lot of people off. I know people like Dave Grohl, and that was their introduction to
Black Sabbath.
Yes. Was through the Ronnie period, you know, Mob Rules and a lot of other people who were in the business, it introduced them to it. But I thought they were really good records, and when I listen to them, it takes me right back, and I think, bloody hell, it was a really good band. And even though we finished up with Ronnie on his last appearances, I really enjoyed it. It was a great band, and it was free, you know. With us now on the Sabbath tours of recent, we had a set that we'd do, and that was it, sort of thing. But when we'd done the set with Ronnie, sometimes we'd change things, and it was a lot more freer. You know, I could play a solo for a long time, and Ronnie encouraged that, and it was good.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that, and it was sort of refreshing, you know.
Yeah, when you look at Mob Rules and Heaven and Hell, I'm hard pressed to pick which one I like better, because I think they're both absolutely brilliant records. I think sometimes Mob Rules, how strong it is, can sometimes be a little overlooked because Heaven and Hell is such a landmark record. But to follow it up a year later with a record of that quality, do you remember was there any big difference in approach to doing Mob Rules versus Heaven and Hell in terms of the writing or the approach to it?
Well, I think at that point, well, obviously Vinnie was on the Mob Rules, so it gave it sort of a different character there. I think one of the first things we did, we did for a movie track.
The title and, track of the record, yeah.
Yeah, and we recorded the original version at John Lennon's house. And it was great because Ronnie and Wendy came over to England, and we were in England, of course, then. And we stayed at the house, and in the studio there, we had the gear set up in one of the rooms for us, and we jammed just the gear of Lennon's. We didn't take our gear; we used the gear that was there. And it had a vibe. The whole thing had a vibe when we'd done the original Mob Rules. But of course, when we actually come to recording it again for the album, Martin Birch wanted to redo it because he said, I want it to sound something in the same context as the rest of the stuff. Because obviously where we'd done it at Lennon's house, it was sounding different. It was more raw. And it was it just got a nice feel about it. But of course, we didn't use that on the album. We used the one we did at the Record Plant. But no, it was a great time, and that was sort of the first thing, I think, that we'd come up with, with Vinnie and that. And of course, then the rehearsals and writing was much the sort of same. We'd go into a room and just play, jam, and tape it.
How long did you have the riff for Sign of the Southern Cross before it showed up on that record? One of the most enormous riffs ever, in my opinion. How long was that one knocking around before, or was it written just for the record?
No, it was written for the record. I mean, most of the stuff I tend to do on the spot. I don't sort of sit and work stuff out much. I've been lucky enough to be able to go into a rehearsal room and start coming up with something. And then somebody would go, oh, what's that? I go, oh, I don't know. and I go, I like that, you know. And so then we'd make some of it. And that was the thing of running a tape at the time as well, because if you don't, you forget what you'd done and don't even realize it. You play something and somebody might go, oh, that was a good riff you've done earlier. And I go, oh, what was that one then? Oh, I can't remember. It was a good one, though. Oh. So we got to the thing of saying, well, what we're going to do is record everything. So if there's anything there and anybody says, oh, that was a good one an hour ago that you did, you can go back and look. So we tend to do it that way.
Tony, I appreciate all the time. I won't keep you much longer, I promise. I wanted to ask you about the live record, Live Evil, that documents those two records. There's so much said about that record over the years, the good, the bad, stuff that it led to Ronnie leaving the first time, going in and altering mixes, arguments. Can you for once set the record straight now that so many years have passed about that period of time and the Live Evil record and what really went on?
You know what, Eddie, I don't really know, because we'd obviously spoke with Ronnie about what went on, and Ronnie totally denied it, and I just think it could have been the engineer at the time because he was obviously in a bit of a state at the end himself. He was drinking a lot and doing this and that and the other. And of course, he told Geezer and me that that Ronnie was coming in later and changing the sounds, changing stuff around, the mixes and stuff. And that's sort of what started it off. Because we'd say to him, oh, it didn't sound the same. And he'd go, and he never said anything for a while. And then one day he just said, I've got to tell you, Ronnie's been coming in and changing stuff around. And I don't know what to say. But as I say, now we can take it with a pinch of salt. Then it was quite, blimey. And it got to a bit of a disagreement between us, and that was it, really.
That's another album that you could think, when you revisit your catalog, what we were talking about Forbidden a second ago, that's another record that you could potentially consider giving a fresh coat of paint to somewhere down the line.
Oh, I'd love to do that, absolutely. Yeah. Definitely.
Because the performances are fantastic. And then just quickly moving forward through the Dio period, one of the things, when you guys did come back together the last time, and of course we should mention you made a great record under the name Heaven and Hell with The Devil You Know there as well, which I want to touch on in a second. But when you came back together for that tour and the final run with Ronnie, one of the things that came out of that for me as a fan was a whole new appreciation for Dehumanizer, because Dehumanizer was hugely overlooked in the U.S. I think the time, the trends in music at the time, Ronnie coming back again, I just think that it really was, even myself as a huge fan of the band in that era, I never really spent the time I should have with that record. And I remember when Ronnie came back in for the third and final time, he said to me, I'm really looking forward to doing some stuff from Dehumanizer live. And I didn't really say it to him at the time, but I'm thinking, I don't know, when you got Heaven and Hell and Mob Rules, I don't know who's going to want to be hearing that. And then you guys came out and started playing After All and I and these songs. And I got to tell you, Tony, ever since that, the biggest thing for me to come out of the last run with Ronnie was a whole new appreciation for Dehumanizer. It shed all new light on that record. I absolutely love it now.
Yeah, I think the thing was, as you said, it came out totally the wrong time. The music trend had changed to a point where, it wasn't sort of accepted as much as stuff was. And it sort of got lost, I think, Dehumanizer. Again, once you hear them again later, you think, oh, blimey, what happened there? I missed that.
Yeah. Do you have a final a recollection and a memory and anything with the last run of touring with Ronnie that you could share? I mean, and making that final record, stuff like Bible Black and all that on there is still so good. Do you have a great memory or something you can share from the final go around with Ronnie?
Well, I mean, it was a great time. Ronnie came over to my house and we worked at my house for a bit, and Geezer came, because Geezer only lived he got a house a few doors away from me. And obviously he lived in California, but he got this house over my side as well. So Geezer stayed there for a bit while we were putting some ideas for that album. And so it enabled us to do bits at my house. Then I come out to California and stayed out there. And then we worked at Ronnie's house. And Vinnie was involved as well. Vinnie come over. Obviously, there was no, at Ronnie's house, there was no drum room or anything. So we ended up, Vinnie tapping on his leg. But it was great. We had a, it was a great time. And we really did put stuff together and pull it apart and put it together and pull it apart. It got funny with Ronnie, really, because we'd be in his, he had this studio in his basement, and we'd be working there, and he'd disappear for half an hour, and he'd go and have his little joint, you know, and come back, and we're all ready to pack up, and he'd come down and go, I've got this idea, and we're going, oh, no, we've had enough now, we're going to go home, and I go, go on, let's have a listen now, and then what about changing this, and what about that, and anyway, we'd do all that for another, we'd stay there another hour and a half or whatever it was, me and Geezer Vin. And then we'd come in the next day, and of course Ronnie wouldn't remember it. He'd go, and he'd go, oh no, I don't like that. He'd go, oh, it was your idea to change it. So, and we had some funny times. But it was great. I mean, I can't knock that at all. I think we had a great time putting that album together, and we had a great final tour with him. It really was. I really did enjoy it, and I really did look forward to going on stage. It was a very professional outfit.
Yeah,
you know, there was no, there was. You knew you were going to go on there and play and do the show and come off, and you'd be, you know, you could talk about it afterwards. Oh, well, maybe we should try that tomorrow. Yeah, okay, we'll try that. And it was good. It was exciting.
Yeah, like yeah, so I've got. Yeah, like I said, I mean, for me, as a, of course, I love the original Sabbath and all the stuff with Ozzy, but for me, coming into it as a kid at Heaven and Hell and being such a fan of that period, and then, you know, years later, being able to actually be a part of it when you guys did the final reunion and coming to Birmingham, I remember doing the interview with you guys that I think was called Roxall Abbey, and we,
that's it, yeah.
We shot that TV interview there, and then going to all the shows and the laughs and the fun times, there was a lot of pranking that went on too. Something, I don't remember the exact story, but something happened at a Jones Beach show with you guys involving me, and I didn't even know about it. Ronnie told you something about me or vice versa. I just remember getting there and one of you guys coming up to me and going, oh, bloody hell, you were bullshitting me or something. But you guys did a lot of pranking, didn't you?
All the time. I mean, one particular one, they got me a treat because I was always bloody pranking around and would get them, and certainly get Vinny, because Vinny weren't quite onto the case with, and then of course then he started pranking around and they got me a treat. I bought the one time we were working in Wales doing the album, and I just bought the brand new Range Rover, just picked it up and drove down to Wales in it, and they'd done, the buggers, Ronnie and Vinnie had gone out and bought a big tin of oil and poured it all under my car. They came in and said, oh, you know, you've got oil coming out your car. I went, get out of it. They went, you've got this sort of oil coming out the gearbox, I think. So I rushed out, God blimey, oh no. And they really got me. They really got me, yeah.
Vinny,
so we did have a laugh. We did have some funny times. It was great. It was a good lineup, man.
Tony, Vinny told
but again,
me.
You know,
no, go ahead. What were you going to say?
I was going to say again. You know, we had some great times with us. We had the Aussie lineup. It was just different. You know,
yeah.
It's a different time, a different period. And I wouldn't knock Ozzy at all because he's a great performer, a great showman, and you know he really is a great character and a great guy. But and again with Ronnie, it was different, and we got on great in a different way. And yeah, fabulous.
Have you heard Ozzy's new record?
I haven't actually. No.
Yeah, that's
I
it's.
Haven't, and that's,
yeah, it, you know, I think he was, unfortunately, I mean, he was just about to get started with some stuff. And then, of course, he's got his own health issues and he's dealing with. And then, of course, nobody can tour right now because of the virus. But are you still, you're in touch with him still? You've spoken to him?
Yeah, we actually stay in touch via text, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And that's best for us because he's not very good on the phone. He doesn't like to talk on the phone. So, you know, it's all very, very short. He used to call me up at bloody 2 o'clock in the morning at one time.
8 hour time difference, right?
Yeah, and I'd be in bed and it'd be Aussie. And I go, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. Oh, is it? Oh, all right, bye then. Oh. So we decided we'd stay in touch by text. So, yeah, I do hear from him. Like, funny enough, I haven't heard from him for the last week, yeah. Which is unusual. But normally, yes, he does stay in touch.
Last thing, I promise you. So you were talking about pranks. So I was talking to Vinny last week, and he told me that when you guys called him to come over for the last run with Ronnie after Bill didn't take part,
yeah.
That he did his own prank where he told, I think he said Wendy had called him, and he told Wendy that he was about 400 pounds now because he let himself go since he saw you last.
Yeah, he did get us, actually. Yeah, he said, oh, God, I've put so much weight on now. It's like, you know, and I thought, oh, blimey, you know. And, of course, obviously, when he walked in the door, we realized.
He said he was looking as he was walking up the driveway to see three heads peering out behind the curtain to see him get out of the car.
See, he's learned how to do it all now, all the years he was with us. he started playing pranks, yeah.
Great stuff. Tony, I can't thank you enough for all the time and for doing this. It's been too long. I miss talking to you, and I really, really hope it's not too long before we get to do it again. Is there anything you want to mention? I know you had you're doing some stuff with Gibson again. I know Gibson Guitars is doing some great work. I know you did you're working with them a little bit. Are you coming out with a new guitar? Or anything that we should know?
Well, they've done an exact copy of my original one on the first three or four albums, which is, I really like it. I've got two of them here at home, and I play them all the time now. I really do like them. And it feels like my original. It feels exactly the same. You know, I was so attached to my original one. You know, it would be in my room all the time when I was on tour, and I would never let it out of my sight. And I feel much the same about these. I've got one in my bedroom, and I play it, and I've got one in my studio. And it feels great. I mean, yeah, they've done a replica of it, and Gibson now, for me, they're really on the case. The owners really want to do the best they can, and they're really determined to do it. I really like their attitude, because after the last owners, that's why I left, really. I wasn't very happy with the way they went about things, and it was a bit of a shamble. But the new owners are really on the case, and I'm really pleased to be working with them.
Yeah, I know those guys, JC and Cesar, really great people, and
yep.
I know they are working hard to sort of reinvigorate the brand and seem to be doing a great job with it, and they're even doing some great stuff now during the quarantine, just trying to keep connected with artists, so it's great to see. Where is the original one, Tony, the very first guitar? You said you never let it out of your sight. Did you lose it? Was it stolen?
Yeah, well,
do you have it?
It was stolen once, and I got it back 6 months later. The record company found out it was in one of these pawn shops, and they got it back for me. And then I had it for a while, and then I decided at the end of that I was too worried to take it on the road with me. Because, you know, when you start touring in a bigger way, and all the gear goes on the truck, and you can no longer take the guitar on the plane with you and all this stuff. It has to go in the hole. I thought, that's it. I'm going to retire it. And I wouldn't take it on the road anymore. I was just worried in case it got stolen or broken. And at the end of the day, it was just sitting in a case with a number of other guitars. And I thought, well, it's a shame, really. And the guy from the Hard Rock that buys all the memorabilia, he said, I'd love to buy that guitar. And I thought, well, that's great, because it can be somewhere where people can see it, it's in a case, it's alive again, you know, instead of being in a box tucked away. And so that's sort of what we did, really. It's in New York in the Hard Rock.
Oh, okay. So it's in the Hard Rock location in Times Square.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, I can go visit it then. It's not that far from me when it opens.
Say hello
again.
Then. Yeah, it's that's what it is, and it's a great guitar, and I was so pleased that Gibson wanted to reproduce that, and they went along. I mean, and they got it taken out of the Hard Rock. They loaned it so they could
replicate
copy it. Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, it really is copied. Every little mark and dent and screw, all the screws are like rusty, like it is on the original. So they really have copied it pretty more near damn it, you know. I mean, obviously inside they couldn't fiddle around too much because they had to sort of take the prints from it and then get it back to New York. But it's near as damaged. The only thing they didn't do was in the control box, when you take the back off, I had mine filled with like a copper plate to sort of help with the sustain or with the feedback. And that's the only thing they haven't done. But I'm playing it here and it sounds great. I really like it. They've duplicated the pickups exactly. They've gone to the trouble of locating the people in Birmingham who made the original pickups. And so they really have gone to town on doing it. It's not cheap, but it's very good.
Well, it's good to hear you're still playing. It sounds like you're being as creative as ever, and we look forward to seeing, and I'm sure I'll be talking to you again, it sounds like, soon, once some of these projects begin to roll out. When do you think we'll see the first thing, depending upon, you know, what happens in the world, I guess, with the virus, right?
Well, again, yeah. I mean, I stay in touch with Ralph every day, so it's Ralph that keeps me in touch with what's going on with that, you see. So I don't know. It's all pretty well up in the air at the moment, isn't it?
Right, yeah.
But yeah, please stay in touch. That'd be great. I'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, well, Tony, I can't thank you enough for the time. And again, I appreciate you doing this so much. It's great to hear from you. It's great that you're doing well. And stay healthy. And hopefully when the world gets back to normal, we'll be able to get together and maybe some of these projects you're working on can start to roll out as well. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you, Eddie. I appreciate it, mate. God bless you.
Huge thanks to Tony Iommi. Man, was that awesome. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed doing it. Thank you so much for listening wherever you are in the world. And a huge thanks to Tony Iommi for taking all that time to hang out and talk with me on my SiriusXM radio show, which, again, every interview you hear on this podcast originates on Trunk Nation on Volume Channel 106 Daily. But after a couple weeks, I get to bring it to you, to everybody free around the world here on the podcast. Spread the word and check out new episodes every single Thursday. Thanks to Katie Irizarry, the producer of the Eddie Trunk podcast. I'll see you guys next Thursday for another all-new episode. Please stay safe, stay healthy. Hopefully we get back to normal soon. And be sure to also check out my website, eddietrunk.com. Have a good week.